Welcome to the Mum's Edit podcast. Erin, welcome to TME. I've been waiting to have you on our podcast for months and months, like since we ever first made contact, because your journey is so important and I think it definitely needs to be shared. But a funny little backstory is that we actually know each other quite well because your daughter Lulu is actually one of my NDIS clients. So I feel like we have that weird little connection where we're kind of like family in a way because we're such a big part of each other's life.
We are, for sure. No, thank you for having me, and it's been so nice to connect with you and have you help us find a support worker and nurse for Lou. It's been life-changing. So, yeah, I'm very, very grateful that we crossed paths.
Me too. For any of our listeners who might not know who you are, do you want to tell us a little bit about you and your little family?
Sure. So my name's Erin. I'm 38 in, 2 weeks. feeling 108. But anyway. Married to Dave, and we have two children, Tom, who is 4 months old, and Luella, who is 3, and she has a very rare and incurable form of epilepsy called infantile spasms that she was diagnosed with pretty early on. Now that she's technically a toddler, she no longer has infantile spasms because it's for infants, but it has progressed into what's called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which along with another form of epilepsy, it's one of the top three most catastrophic and worst forms of epilepsy that you can have. So it's a pretty challenging life for us, but mainly for her.
Yeah, of course. Let's go right back to the very beginning. How was your pregnancy with Lulu?
My pregnancy was pretty uneventful. I did have influenza A in my second trimester, which I was hospitalized for and given Tamiflu. So the pregnancy itself was, it was pretty boring, to be honest. But, you know, you don't really know what to expect or what's coming. It's such a, as a first-time experience, you just kind of taking it day by day because you have nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And how was her birth as well? Was that all straightforward or were there any complications?
I guess, you know, as far as complications go, there would be ones definitely far worse than what I experienced. For me, I did find her birth quite traumatic in the sense that she was born full term, 40 plus 4 days. And I actually went into labor on a Friday. My waters broke, but it wasn't that, you know, movie scene where you get that full gush of water all over your feet and it's really quite obvious.
Yeah.
I was actually climbing into bed and I had a small gush and I kind of went, oh, you know, was that, wasn't it? I don't know. Again, nothing to compare it to. It could just be leakage. Like it could be an array of different things.
Yeah, and you're like, is that wee?
is it wee? Have I wet myself? But I think I kind of knew it wasn't. But it just wasn't significant enough for me to be sure. And then it happened again. Oh, so I got up, put a pad on, went back to bed, laid back down, happened again. So I rang the hospital and I said, oh, I think my waters have broken. And the midwife said to me, well, you would know.
And oh, I hate that.
Yeah. Really frustrating thing to say to a first-time mum because you don't know. Well, I didn't know. It wasn't obvious to me having never, had a baby, never been pregnant before. So I had been pregnant, but not at this full term. They rang the hospital and she said, you would know if your waters broke. And I said, well, I'm not sure. So what should I do? And they just said, put a pad on and, you know, if it gets worse or anything changes, you know, give us another call back. Nothing really did, but in hindsight now, I know that was definitely my waters breaking.
Yeah.
And so I labored at home all day Saturday, all day Sunday. Sorry, I rang the hospital back and I said, oh, look, I think my waters have – sorry, I rang them back and I said, I think my waters have broken. And they said, look, see how you go overnight and then if you'd like to come in on Saturday morning, do that. it's up to you. But they didn't seem overly concerned, and I didn't really know if anything was really happening or not happening. So I thought we'd just see how it went. I did decide to go up to hospital on the Saturday morning, not in a rush, but, you know, wanted to see what was happening. They did a swab to check for any amniotic fluid to determine if my waters had broken. They couldn't detect any amniotic fluid, so it was determined that they my waters had not broken, and they sent me home. What I know now is that my obstetrician actually wasn't called at that time, and so he was actually not even aware that I had even visited the hospital. So the midwives actually didn't relay that information to him, which is probably not right. He probably really should have been called to possibly do some more investigation, mm-hmm. to determine if I needed to be induced.
Yeah.
So I then was at home laboring, you know, Saturday and then Sunday, and things really started to ramp up Sunday afternoon. I was actually over at my parents' place, and I was having contractions in their kitchen, and my mom was like, Erin, you're in labor. Like, you're about to have a baby.
Oh my God.
Am I? Is this it? Like, I wasn't sure. Yeah,
and it just doesn't feel real, because you're like, I've been waiting 9 months for this moment. And then especially because you went to the hospital and you thought your waters had broken and they said they hadn't. It's like, you're in limbo. You don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And so I was like, oh, well, like, this is it. Oh, okay, right. Yeah, I need to go home. So went home. I did have a doula, because I felt I didn't really want any family members. I wanted someone separate too that was able to kind of guide me through, but I really wanted a female presence. Mm-hmm. So I had a doula, and she actually lives not far from me, and she you know, we rang her and told her what was happening, and she just guided us through, and we actually found her through a birthing course we did, and she was just guiding Dave on what to do, and we put the TENS machine on and things like that, and did massage over the ball, all of that stuff. And, you know, before we knew it, it was, you know, things had started to really ramp up, and I really didn't handle contractions very well. Mm-hmm. I remember when they were happening, I would kind of shoot up in bed, because she was kind of like, look, they might intensify, but go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be laying there and they would happen, and I would shoot up out of bed, have to kind of get out, get onto my knees and lean over the side of my bed, and I was screaming into my pillow. They were so intense, and I just couldn't harness my breathing. So everything I'd learned at the birthing course just went out the window. And anyway, long story short, I labored at home until about 1 a.m. on Monday morning, and then rang the hospital. And at first the midwife wasn't overly kind of concerned. I think she was a bit like, oh, yeah, here we go, another drama queen.
Yeah. That's awful, though.
Yeah, it wasn't really nice, and it's frustrating, because everyone's pain threshold is very different.
Mm.
So what is intense for me and maybe intense for you or someone else is, you know, completely different, but they seem to kind of gauge everyone off the same frequency as far as that goes, which is strange.
100%. And just going back, sorry to interrupt, you've got two children now. Do you feel like second time around giving birth, like, you were heard more as a second time mum?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. But I think I made that really clear.
Yeah, I
went in with really kind of clear intentions, and I really knew what I wanted from my birthing experience with Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was completely different, because I had a vaginal birth with Luella, which was assisted delivery, mm-hmm. and I had a planned C-section with Tom. So two very, very different birthing experiences and two very different outcomes.
Yeah.
So once we got up to hospital for Luella's birth, I was already 5 centimetres dilated, so they knew that things were really happening. I labored for another 2 hours there and only got to 7 centimetres. And because I've kind of been in labor all day Saturday and all day Sunday, I was exhausted
and of course.
I couldn't even stand up. So I ended up opting for an epidural, had a really good sleep. And then at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my obstetrician came in and said, okay, you're 10 centimetres, time to push.
How lovely sleeping through the last 3 centimetres, like epidural. Yeah. Game changer.
Honestly, I needed it. Like we all did.
Yeah.
Like Dave and I were just exhausted. So
So then
time to push. And I had this kind of need or this desire to want to be on either all fours or up on my knees leaning over. Mm-hmm. But once you have an epidural, you know, they just keep you bed bound.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating because that's just not, I just knew gravity, I needed gravity to help.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really supported in where I was giving mm-hmm. birth. So, you know, on your back, pushing, nothing was happening. And eventually she was born 2.5 hours later with a vacuum delivery,
mm-hmm.
Which was even more painful than the contractions, if I'm being honest. Him putting that on was so painful. And, yeah,
so with your epidural, did you still have, like, some sensation then? Like it wasn't completely numb?
That's right. So not completely numb. Like I could feel them coming along.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using more of me as a gauge rather than the monitor, like the strap monitor that mm-hmm. that goes on. So they could see when it was kind of building, but I was able to probably feel it earlier on than what the machine was tracking.
Yeah.
And so then she was delivered at about 3:30 in the afternoon and we were over the moon.
And what was those first few weeks like at home before, you know, you knew what you were going to find out? What was those first few weeks like?
If I'm being really honest, it was incredibly hard.
Mm-hmm.
Postnatal depression, hit for me and I just didn't know what to do. And I didn't really feel like I had a village around me to support me and show me. It's really interesting how insular motherhood has become and how, you know, it's just everything's so behind closed doors now, whereas, you know, a long time ago, everyone was kind of chipping in and helping out.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt left to my own devices to really work it out. And don't get me wrong, everyone is. Like there's no manual, so I understand that.
Yeah.
But I just didn't feel like I had the support and I spiraled downhill really fast,
mm-hmm.
really quickly.
Yeah.
I was in tears a lot. My breastfeeding experience with Luella was awful. She wasn't latching properly despite speaking to multiple lactation consultants and eventually I stopped breastfeeding at about 5 weeks
mm-hmm.
and then I expressed for another 4 and then I just gave into formula and it was the best thing for both of us.
Yeah.
I wish I actually had done it sooner, to be honest.
Yeah. Did you feel any pressure like when you were struggling with breastfeeding to keep trying or did
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So many people said to me, you've just got to push through the pain and just get through it.
Mm.
And it was like, surely it shouldn't be as painful as I'm experiencing because every time she needs to feed, it just felt like my nipple was being ripped off.
Yeah.
It was so awful. And I don't have a great high pain threshold. So, you know, maybe what was doable for somebody else certainly was not doable for me. I really didn't enjoy breastfeeding at all.
Yeah. And even so, like, those few hours between breastfeeding when you weren't in pain, you knew that in a few hours you were going to have to be back in pain again. It's like a never-ending cycle.
Builds.
Yeah. Especially when you're already struggling. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So that, you know, that mental anxiety of like, oh, my gosh, I've got to do this again.
Yeah.
And she was taking a really long time to feed as well.
Yeah.
It wasn't like the I kept hearing people at Mother's Group saying how they were having, you know, 10 minutes one side, 10 minutes the other, and they were done. And I was like, oh, my gosh, Luella's on the breast forever.
Oh, my God.
So I didn't know what I was doing. I felt like I'd just been thrown into the deep end and I really was struggling to figure out motherhood in those really early weeks.
And at what age did you begin to notice that something wasn't quite right with Lulu?
So I first noticed something odd at around 8 weeks of age. She started to do this very small, very quick, like blink and you'd miss it movement,
mm.
which was almost like a crunch, like sit-up type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so fast and so subtle I almost didn't catch everyone. I wasn't sure how many she was having. And I knew it wasn't right. My gut told me something was off. Mm-hmm. And I asked lots of people and they just all, you know, as people do, try to reassure you that everything's fine, that your baby is healthy. That's what everybody does, you know. No one wants to alarm a new mum.
Yeah.
Which I understand, but in hindsight, I think I should have listened to that intuition that seems to kick in when you become a mum, mm-hmm. that I just knew something wasn't quite right, and it started out really small, mm-hmm. but then it started to build and became a lot more frequent, and I was noticing it a lot more often over the next kind of fortnight or so. And at that point, she had woken up from she'd fallen asleep in the pram in the bassinet, and we were downstairs next to her, and she'd woken up and I went over and she looked like she just wasn't present. She'd mm-hmm. looked off with the fairies. And oddly, my grandmother was diagnosed with epilepsy late in life, mm-hmm. at about 45, absent seizures particularly. Mm-hmm. And oddly as well, I'd also dated a guy years prior when I lived overseas who also had been diagnosed with absent seizures.
Oh, my gosh. I just got goosebumps because it's like such a
huge
part of
it's like it'd been following me around.
Yeah. Like it was going to be really such odd. A huge part of your life, and it had kind of been trickled in throughout.
Literally. It's like in some ways the universe was kind of preparing me like, hey, here's the signs. Get ready because it's coming for you.
Yeah.
And I'd failed to really notice them for Lou until that moment where she woke up in her bassinet and I went over and I just immediately thought she had a seizure. Mm. She's had a seizure because she looked so much like my grandmother and this person I had dated, this blank look like she was just not here. And I rang my mom and I said, Mom, what would a baby's, you know, seizure look like? And, you know, she said all the things that everyone would say. She would convulse, it would be really obvious, she would shake and, you know, have those typical kind of expected symptoms that you see in movies. Mm. But she didn't have that. She was a little bit rigid but not stiff like a surfboard. Mm-hmm. And I just went, you know what, I think we need to go up to emergency. This isn't right. And we went up and things really escalated quite quickly. And she, by the time, as soon as we said, I think she's having seizures, the Children's Hospital at Randwick did take it very seriously. They took us straight through into emergency. And by the time we'd put her on the bed, she was going into full-blown clusters of infantile spasms. Mm. And a neurologist came down, you know, almost immediately and diagnosed her on the spot.
I've just got goosebumps again because it's like you literally, if you hadn't had seen that one in the pram, like you went straight away and then it all just kind of kicked off from there, like luckily.
Yeah, everything unraveled in that moment.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, you know, and, you know, that she's considered to have quite early onset at only 11 weeks diagnosed. But even earlier, really, when I first started noticing it around 8 weeks, it's considered very early. But it was so early on that it was really tricky to know whether she was typically developing at that point or not. And again, being a first-time mum, I didn't know what she should or shouldn't be doing.
No.
You know, you follow the Wonder Weeks apps and things like that and you have a bit of an idea of what is supposed to be happening. But, yeah, I guess I didn't know what I was seeing. I didn't know that those spasms were seizures, number one, and were a really, really very serious type of seizure that requires – you know, it's considered a medical emergency, infantile spasms. Mm. You know, so if there are any parents out there that are thinking that they might be seeing these strange, jerky type movements where, you know, often the knees come up to the chest like a crunch. Sometimes it'll be an eye deviation where the eyes go upwards or up to, you know, the left or the right. Maybe it's a really distinct shoulder shrug. That if they're seeing things like that in repetitive clusters, that could be signs of infantile spasms, and it's not worth waiting to see their GP or a paediatrician, because often they've never encountered infantile spasms because it's quite rare. So their best bet is to actually go straight up to a children's hospital and see a paediatric neurologist who will be able to tell you anyway, because even if a parent like me had waited, they would have sent me up to hospital anyway. They wouldn't probably diagnose in a doctor's office.
That's right.
They would wait for a specialist. So and like you know, we said before, everything just really came undone in that moment.
Yeah. And it's just, I'm just even thinking back to like when you have a newborn, especially around that 8 week mark, like they do odd things. Like they are jerky and they do strange things. So it could be so easy to miss that. Like
really absolutely. Quickly. Yeah. The startle reflex is often, you know, used as like a bit of a misdiagnosis. They'll just say, oh no, that's just the startle reflex. That's what that is. And, you know, I was definitely seeing that with Luella, but this felt different. And I don't know how I knew, but I just knew it was something off.
Yeah. And I saw a post on your Instagram that was posted like soon after all of this had happened, and you were told by the treating neurologist at the time that Lou was seizure free, and you were kind of sent out of the hospital with no education at all around her condition or what was to come. How did that feel, kind of being unsupported in that way and kind of walking into the dark with no idea what was to follow?
It was the most frustrating experience, and I use that word, you know, in place of others that I could. Being sent home, being told she was seizure free, in hindsight, was really the wrong thing for that neurologist to do. And also, I think a lot of, in our experience, a lot of neurologists have used really high level medical terminology to inform us about what infantile spasms were. And when you are a parent in crisis on a neurology ward and your child is having seizures, trying to interpret what, you know, epileptic encephalopathy is, it's like you'd never even heard the words.
No.
I mean, you know, in your head you think, okay, seizures, this is treatable, we'll just take a medication and she'll be okay, because that's what people assume with epilepsy, that everything will be fine and we will find seizure control.
Yeah.
Unbeknownst to us, we fall into about an 80% category with infantile spasms where they are untreatable, and a 30% category with epilepsy, you know, worldwide, where none of the medications work for Luella. So, you know, we've tried and failed about 15 anti-epileptics. And, you know, at the time, she wasn't having seizures because they started her on steroid treatment, which is one of the first line treatments for infantile spasms. But to tell us that we were, you know, home and hosed, you know, it really was misinformation, and really felt so misguided, because when we started to wean those steroids, because they are only a short treatment, the cycle is quite short in time frame, the spasms returned. And to not really be given the heads up on that can happen, felt like we had just walked into a fire, you know, and we just couldn't get out. And then, you know, on top of it all, they also give you they gave us these black and white A4 printed out stuff that, you know, you can just basically download off the internet of information sheets.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't even know where we put all that paperwork in the 10 days that we were there. I mean, we're not sitting down and, you know, really reading this piece of paper that's been thrust under our nose while our daughter has seizures.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like we were really set up to not be able to absorb what was being delivered to us because of the situation. it's almost like, and I've suggested this to the hospital, that they should create little folders for parents. Mm-hmm. They give this information to them at the time, and then maybe that information goes into a folder that then the parent is sent home with, that they can then refer to once they're back in their own environment and can maybe think a little bit more clearly.
Mm.
So that they can then refer to these documents, because I'm telling you, most of the documents they gave us, and I think ended up in the bin, not on purpose, but just because we weren't interested at that time. We were just so panicked,
yeah,
and in a complete state of stress and anxiety.
Yeah, you're in flight.
We weren't able to sit down and read.
Yeah, no, and you're just processing every single second. How am I going to get through this? You know, how's Lulu going to get through this? You know, not even thinking about, yeah, reading a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
So what does her prognosis look like? In which ways will this continue to affect her life?
So the prognosis for her from doctors is that she will most likely never walk, never talk, never self-feed, never toilet herself, and she will have severe cognitive disability for her entire life. Mm-hmm. It's said with infantile spasms, if you can't control the seizures, that, you know, her IQ will be less than 30. So it's a pretty dire prognosis. Mm. And, you know, how it will continue to evolve, as I briefly mentioned initially, is that often if an infantile spasms progresses into Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which is just as catastrophic and just as severe. But it's more tonic-clonic seizures, so the convulsing,
mm-hmm.
where she loses consciousness, you know, her breathing is affected, and, you know, it those seizures are a very, what's the word I'm looking for, debilitating on her day-to-day life, because they then wipe her out. You know, she sleeps a lot at the moment. Yeah, and we're not seeing a lot of her right now.
I'm so sorry, Erin. It's just the most cruel thing that you can ever imagine. It really is. And I suppose in some ways you probably feel like you're grieving someone who's still alive.
Yeah, absolutely. Epilepsy, or the type of epilepsy that Luella has, is the cruelest illness I know of. I mean, and it's not a competition, and it's not a comparison. I mean, cancer's for sure up there. Mm. But, you know, epilepsy actually causes pain.
Yeah.
You know, it causes the brain to experience like an electrical frequency that is just too much for the brain to handle. Mm. It's like a computer going, you know, overheating and going into overdrive and turning itself off.
Yeah.
And then trying to reboot and just get back to it. So imagine the brain doing that over and over and over, because you can't control the seizures.
Mm.
It causes brain damage, and it causes irreparable damage. And we are left with very limited options that are very, very scary.
Speaking of that, there was an option thrown to you about, as you said, an incredibly complex and very daunting surgery for Luella. Do you want to tell our listeners what that actually involves?
Sure. So it's called a hemispherectomy, which is essentially either severing or removing an entire hemisphere of the brain. So we have two hemispheres, and there are four parts that make up each hemisphere. So doctors want to remove the entire left hemisphere of Luella's brain.
Mm.
There's two ways of going about the surgery. One is called a functional, where they just disconnect and they leave the tissue in, but essentially it becomes like an island,
mm-hmm.
and is not connected but would continue to seize on its own. However, a lot of neurosurgeons don't like to do that. They just like to get out the bad brain,
mm-hmm.
and take out the actual tissue, and they leave a vacant cavity.
Mm.
So she would have half a brain.
Yeah.
If we went ahead with that surgery, it's incredibly invasive. You know, it's a one-shot only operation. You know, we can't go back. We can't do it again. We can't try and rewire anything. It's not like putting a pin in a leg and saying, okay, it didn't take. Let's try again in 6 or 12 months or whatever.
Once it's done, it's done.
That's right.
And what are the statistics like of that being a success?
The stats are about a 60% seizure freedom outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So 40% of the surgeries don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's 60% more chance than we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm being really honest, I'm petrified of the surgery. Mm-hmm. I see far too many children where the surgery doesn't work because neurologists and neurosurgeons look at success as purely seizure freedom. They don't look at anything else or any other deficits that come with the surgery.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if they are to whichever the left side of the brain, for example, controls the right side of the body and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So what normally happens is children that have hemispherectomies, they have a permanent right side like paralysis for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Most will learn to walk, but because they are actually severing the motor strip, which connects the two hemispheres in the brain, it seems to affect the hand and the arm the most. So she will never have any fine motor function in her right hand. So, for example, she'd never be able to write with a pen, pick up a paintbrush, any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It would be more of a helper hand where she would use like the back of her wrist to push something forward or something like that, but mm-hmm. she wouldn't be able to grab or hold onto anything.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be limited to the function of that right arm. As I said, she may walk. They expect her to, but they don't know if that would happen. And she would probably permanently have to wear a what's called like an AFO, which is an ankle and foot orthotic that goes over the foot and the ankle all the time in order for her to stay balanced. She would lose peripheral vision in both of her eyes. Initially, the right side of her face would be quite droopy and kind of it would look a little bit like she'd had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that resolves, often it doesn't. So, you know, there might be a constant drooling out of that side of her mouth, which can also lead to a lot of feeding issues. And then it goes down the realm of, you know, how children respond or how they are affected by only having half a brain. A lot of children self-harm because you're supposed to have two hemispheres, not one. Now, neuroplasticity is said to be incredible, and I have seen it, and there are many children out there where it has been a success and they do quite well.
Yeah.
But they will always have permanent disabilities. They will always have, you know, a low cognitive ability and you know, then some children will jump, run, all of those things, ride bikes, and that's amazing. But not every child has a successful outcome. A lot of kids have issues with the vacant cavity that's left. They have to have shunts put in. Like I could go on and on about all of these other medical issues that children experience after these operations that no one talks about.
Mm.
And it still is just as challenging as having the epilepsy. I mean, really we're just trading disabilities and we're trading medical complexity with the operation.
Yeah. And I hate crying when I do interviews because it's not about me. I know this is your story to tell, but just breaks my heart so much because you like look at photos of her and she's just, you can tell, the most pure soul, and it's just so unfair. And I guess that weight on your shoulders as a mother, like here's an option and you've got to decide, you know, what you want to do. It's like rolling the dice. Like
it totally is. And I feel really I don't feel equipped as a human being to be able to make such huge decisions for another person
mm.
without their consent.
Yeah.
And obviously that is a huge part of parenting. You do that for a number of years. You make decisions for your children that you think are best for them. And I'm very aware that, you know, that is parenthood, that is motherhood. But to this level, it's something that I am, rightly or wrongly, I feel unable to say yes to surgery. Yeah. I'm really frightened of what she will be like afterwards, as far as yeah, what her life will look like, what it will look like for us. You know, yeah, and it really does depend on how you look at things. I always used to think I was a cup half full person.
Yeah.
But I think I'm in now with everything that we've experienced, I'm probably a cup half empty.
Yeah.
And it's a really bad mindset to have, but with the depression and the anxiety that I live, I don't feel capable of making such a huge decision, because at the end of the day, I have to live with that. And if it doesn't go well, I am to blame. I did that. I did that to my daughter. And I don't know if it's what she would want or what she would choose.
It's just impossible.
It feels impossible. And I'm very aware that it might be the wrong choice. And it might be too late at some point. And I also will have to live with that.
So have they said to you that there's a cutoff on at what point she'll be able to have the surgery and when she won't?
Essentially, if the seizures continue, they are starting to cause damage on the right side of the brain, which they at this point assume is healthy and should recover if we – and that neuroplasticity would kick in if we were to do the surgery. I mean, you know, I understand that these are specialists, and you know they've got years of study outside of me. But these are all just statistics that, while they assume Luella should be okay, they don't know. And I think being completely responsible for that and having to literally sign her life away and saying that, you know, we chose this.
Yeah.
It's a really hard, it's a really hard decision to make. Like I said before, it's 60% more chance than we have now, but that 60% in my mind is only 10% more than average. It's not like it's 80 or 90%, you know, successful outcome, and you know we would be so unlucky to fall in that, you know, 10 or 15%.
There's
a very high chance that it will not work, but there's also a very high chance that it could work. So it's like we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. It's like no choice is the right choice. But to answer your question, sorry I digressed, is that, you know, they actually said when she was 6 months old, we went to Melbourne and they said, you know, for a second opinion, and they said that, you know, you should do the surgery and get it out now. They assume that the younger you do it, the better off, because the brain has more time, or the leftover brain has more time to take over and do the work of the entire brain. So essentially the longer we leave it, potentially the worse it could be. And I won't lie in saying that things aren't getting worse. They are. You know, so look, some children have this procedure done in their teens. Some people have it done with their adults. It really depends on the severity and, you know, how bad things are. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on us to make a decision probably this start of Christmas. You know, there's a few other things that I'm exploring outside of surgery that I really need to tick off quite quickly, and see if we have any success with that. And if not, then, yeah, I guess we'll we probably will most likely end up on the operating table. And my husband has always said, you know, don't delay the inevitable. Don't delay what you will inevitably do. And it's such sound advice, and you can apply it to probably any other moment in your life. Mm. But this just feels, this feels too big for me as a human.
Yeah.
I just, I'm not wired to make these choices, to make these decisions. I feel very out of, it feels so out of league for me. It's too big.
Yeah.
A decision to be put on me.
You almost wish she could just tell you what to do.
Yeah, if she, like, if she said to me, "Mom, just do it."
Mm.
If she could talk to me, she could tell me, I would do it tomorrow. I'll do it today. I'd do it in an hour. But I ask her every day. I actually look her in the eyes every single day and I ask her, "Do you want this surgery? Because please tell me." And maybe the seizures are the way to interpret it, but I just don't know. It's just the epilepsy and no one knows why, no one knows how. It's this anomaly. It's not a genetic condition despite my grandmother having it. Mm. We've done the most top-level genetic testing available in the world and it came back clear. It is not a metabolic issue, meaning it's not how like glucose and sugar is processed through the brain. It's not that. So doctors assume it's a structural issue, meaning that her brain just didn't form properly in utero, but they don't know, like they don't actually 1,000,000% know. I think I just wish I could crystal ball and just know whether what life would be like to a certain degree.
Mm.
I mean, you know, you look at a lot of the other kids that have done really well and you want to use that as a guide and go, surely we're in that percentage, like that's got to be us. But I know far too many families that have fallen into that 40% and life for them is really hard. Mm. It's really hard. It's just as hard or if not harder than having the seizures because they haven't come out seizure free and now they have all of these children have all these other permanent disabilities that they can't change and they can't go back.
It's just devastating, honestly. It's not even any words in the English vocabulary that can express how sorry I am.
Yeah, thank you. It's just a barbaric condition. It's just brutal.
Mm.
It's just barbaric. And I can't believe something so awful exists.
Mm. And that it's not, this form of epilepsy is not even spoken about that often. I didn't even know it existed until I came across your Instagram page. You know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'd never heard of it. I mean, most people have heard of epilepsy.
Yeah.
But epilepsy is just an umbrella term for an array of different seizure types.
Mm.
Hers is very, very severe. And we can't control it. Nothing works.
Somewhere along the way, you decided to have another baby.
Yes.
What was that decision like for you and Dave to decide, when are we going to bring someone else into our family throughout all of this?
It was really hard. It wasn't something that, you know, we both just jumped at. I was probably more ready than Dave, and for a number of reasons. And I'll be honest in saying some of them are a little bit selfish, but some of them aren't. I desperately wanted a different experience with motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had been taken away from both Dave and I as parents with, you know, we were in hospital at only 11 weeks of age and we spent the first like first year of her life in and out of hospital, you know, watching her being drugged up on so many medications and we didn't have any kind of normality with this diagnosis and I really wanted that. And I craved it. And it doesn't mean that I don't love my daughter, but I do not love epilepsy. I do not embrace epilepsy and just say, like, this is okay. I love her to pieces more than anyone. But I needed to heal my heart. And I knew that adding to our family would be a really beautiful way to do that.
Mm.
Yeah. But I'm also really aware that it's a lot of pressure to put on a sibling. It's a lot of pressure to put on our family. It's a lot of pressure to put on Luella.
Mm-hmm.
There's you know, it was a really considered choice. And we determined that we couldn't just live epilepsy and we couldn't just live, you know, certain aspects of disability for the rest of our lives. We needed some balance.
Yeah.
And we really wanted that. And not just for us, but for Luella as well.
Yeah.
Someone to love her equally as us. Someone to, you know, advocate for her when she's older as well. You know, a lot of parents never have to think about what will happen to their children when they die. Mm. But we have to consider that. Yeah. We have to start thinking now about, you know, David, like I'm almost 40, Dave's 40. You know, when we don't have a huge amount of time, like it's a long time, don't get me wrong, but, you know, we don't have 50 or 60 years ahead of us. We're not in our 20s.
Yeah.
And, you know, working out what will happen with our daughter when we die, who may not be able to care for herself. It's unlikely she will ever be able to care for herself or live independently. So, we need more family around her to support her. So it might seem really selfish, but I'm trying to think about Luella, and it's a really, it's like the head noise and the kind of, excuse my French, but the head fuck it creates on working around whether you should or shouldn't. It has so many pros and cons no matter which way you look at it. Mm. Is it the right thing for Tom? The amount of pressure that's going to put on him when he's older. You know, it's a lot.
Yeah.
But it would just be awful for her to be left alone in this world and end up in some system that is already broken. I mean, that would just be awful.
No. And I know it sounds cliche, but at the end of the day, what you've given Luella and what you've given Tom is the biggest gift of all. You know, even though Tom will have responsibility when he's older to step into those shoes, like I guarantee you when he is 80, he is not going to have that as a life regret, you know? That will probably be one of his biggest honours in life.
I think so too. And, you know, Luella is an honour.
Yeah.
She is.
Yeah.
And I think people often misconstrue my grief with her instead of epilepsy. She is not her diagnosis.
No.
Her diagnosis to me is completely separate to who she is as a human, who she is as my daughter. But I don't have any compassion, love, or acceptance for epilepsy, but I love my daughter beyond anything.
Were you able to enjoy your pregnancy with Tom at all, or was it mostly consumed with anxiety or fear that lightning could strike twice?
Look, you can't help but think that, you know, things will go wrong again. It's just part of the anxiety that I live with, and often it's all consuming. So I was able to enjoy my pregnancy with Tom, but only to an extent, because for I think 7, 8 months of the pregnancy, I was flying solo. And because Luella can't walk, can't talk, can't feed herself, trying to lift a 15-kilo child who has no tone, she's hypertonic. So that typical, when you pick up a typically developing child, they kind of take their weight for you and they wrap their legs around you when you pick them up, and that whole monkey grip thing is instinctively there. None of that is there for Luella. So it's like carrying a bag of cement around, like a sandbag. And you kind of have to counterbalance your own body in order for her to stay upright. Like she has trunk control, but it's still very, very hard to handle her, to maneuver her.
Especially
when I'm heavily pregnant. Yeah. It got really hard towards the end. I had a really hard time towards the end of the pregnancy, and then I also had I hemorrhaged at 36 weeks. I had a big bleed, and it was absolutely pushing myself and going too hard, and trying to do everything on my own because we didn't have support.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was, but in the same breath, in my mind, I knew that everything would be okay with Tom.
Yeah.
I just knew. Whereas with Luella, I don't know why, but I had this gut feel through her pregnancy that she wasn't healthy.
Yeah.
And I cannot pinpoint why. It was just this very strange fear. I don't know, law of attraction and all that, I'm not sure, but
no, I think mother's intuition most likely.
Yeah.
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 And so how are those weeks, so leading up to Tom's birth, once you got past the hemorrhage, I remember literally I turned on your story notifications. I was like, I need to know what's happening with the hemorrhage. I was freaking out. But everything turned out to be okay. But did you have to go to hospital and be on bed rest at all?
I did. So my obstetrician, and she knew everything that we'd experienced, I went actually with a completely different hospital and a completely different obstetrician, and I went with a female.
Yeah.
I really didn't want another male obstetrician this time round, and I'm so glad I made that choice because she was able to not only give me the patient care that I needed, but the compassion based on our circumstances with Lou, and she just made sure that I had the best care possible, and she put me on bed rest for the remainder of my pregnancy with Tom. And yeah, I was under strict instructions not to do anything. It was a bit bittersweet in the sense that I needed to stop.
Yeah,
and it was my body really screaming at me to pause and start listening to the pain I was feeling. But you know, at the same breath, it meant that I was quite distanced from Lou. You know, so it was really a tricky time, and it remains to be, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, and we'll go into that soon. But first, I want to know about the elective cesarean, because I loved seeing how that was such a positive experience for you, and how, you know, you came full circle and you were like, I'm doing formula feeding right away. And I just loved how you were so confident in your choices this time and how you were so excited to have a different experience. How was that experience of going in, knowing exactly when the cesarean was going to be and knowing that you were going to walk out, you know, that day with a baby?
It was absolutely incredible, and I can't surmise it any other way. Mm. It was just beautiful and everything that I needed and everything that I had hoped for. It was just really nice being able to choose the date. And I think because so much of Luella's life now is uncontrollable, not just from a diagnosis, but we just don't know what is coming.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is like not knowing what's coming and having that element of, okay, well, you know, she's going to start walking soon, she's going to go to school, all of the regular things that you think are coming aren't. And so it's caused this real sense of wanting to be in control. Probably even, I mean, I'm wired that way generally, but it's really heightened now, and I really needed to be in control and aware and know exactly what was going to happen with Tom's birth and not have any surprises. Yeah. Now, that's not to say that something couldn't have happened, but at least it was a controlled environment, and my obstetrician made sure that virtually the entire maternity ward, all of the midwives that were part of the surgery, all of the doctors, every single person that came in contact with us and me knew our history, knew our story with Luella, and they went above and beyond to make sure that we just had the most beautiful experience, and it was it exceeded all of my expectations.
And how was the postpartum phase after giving birth to Tom? Did you experience any postpartum depression or anxiety again, or was it just a different wave of emotions altogether given the complexity of the situation?
I didn't have any depression. I, as you mentioned before, I chose to not breastfeed, and I went straight into formula feeding with Tom. So as soon as he was born, that very first feed, Dave did that, and, you know, it was really beautiful. You know, I think there's a lot of pressure in society for women to breastfeed, and sometimes it just doesn't work or it just doesn't feel right for you. And I think every mum should listen to that. And that's what I chose this time around. for collectively for us as a family, because I didn't want to go through what I went through with Luella again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it caused a lot of stress, me not having a great breastfeeding experience. And that shouldn't also be read that was Luella's fault. It just didn't work for us.
Yeah.
You know, there's no blame. It just didn't work. So, it was a very different experience coming home, even the hospital. I did things so differently that I didn't know I was supposed to do with Luella. Mm. I didn't know I was supposed to do like skin to skin to form this bond.
Mm.
When Luella was born, you know, the midwives were always wrapping her, breastfeed. Then, you know, you wrap her and you put her to sleep and you put her in that little clear bassinet next to your bed. And that's what I did. I didn't do all of this skin to skin because it wasn't encouraged. Mm. I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I did the opposite with Tom. I made sure that we did those things because that's what you're supposed to do if that's what you want, if that's what you choose. And I really made sure that I took the time to bond with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care that the washing didn't get done or that we maybe got takeout, you know, 3 or 4 nights in a row. I just immersed myself into an experience that I feel not only was right for us as a family, right for Tom, right for Lou, but also for me.
Yeah.
And that might sound selfish, but I really needed to do that. And it has been one of the most healing experiences for me ever. It's been really beautiful.
How have you found the juggle between caring for Lulu now and Tom? So obviously you've got your support worker, Crystal, who is there throughout the week, and so that helps the juggle. But when it's just you on your own, how do you manage, like if she's having a seizure and Tom's crying, or like how do you split yourself in two? I mean, it's hard enough for any mum to split themselves in two, but especially when your child has a disability.
Yeah, it feels impossible. And at the time, it gives me a huge amount of anxiety. Mm. You know, I'm trying to learn along the way on how to best manage it. You know, I had a moment not too long ago where Luella had a seizure. I was on my own and Luella had a seizure in her high chair. I had Tom in a carrier on my chest. And it was like, what do I do first? Mm. When you're and I panic with her seizures, and you know, maybe in time I won't, but I really do panic. And I know I shouldn't, but I can't help it because they're really hard to watch. And it, you know, it is quite traumatizing, you know, for me, but you know, more so for her.
Mm.
And in that moment, when I panic, like anyone, you don't think straight. So trying to work out what the best option is because, you know, her seizures don't last, you know, 10 or 20 minutes. In the world of epilepsy with tonic seizures, they are considered quite mild,
mm-hmm.
despite how bad they are. So, you know, by the time it would have taken me to get Tom out of the carrier, her seizure would have been over, and it was. So, but, you know, I've got a carrier on. She's in the high chair. I've got to try and get, you know, the tray table off. It's getting stuck. I'm hesitating because do I, you know, just take off the carrier and kind of pop Tom down on the lounge, run back to her, like, what do you do first? And, you know, trying to get her up and out of a high chair while you've got another child strapped to you to get her safely on the floor, it is actually very hard. Mm. Like I said, she doesn't, and she's stiff and rigid, and you'd think that that would make it a lot easier, but it doesn't.
Mm.
And, you know, it was, it just became this really overwhelming experience, and I've learned to do things differently now. But in those initial phases where you're kind of working out how to best manage it, and every scenario is different, it's really tricky. So now I have to learn that if I am feeding Tom and she has a seizure, or I am holding Tom and she has a seizure, I just have to kind of put everything down safely. So put Tom down safely, stop feeding, and go to her. And that's obviously, you know, what I was doing in that moment when she was in the high chair anyway. But it just sends you into a tailspin because you're having to choose between your children. Yeah. And a medical emergency like a seizure is obviously takes priority.
Mm.
But when you're not able to physically get when I wasn't able to get Tom out of the carrier easily and quickly, it's kind of just like mental overload. Like I just got stuck in what to do.
Yeah.
So it is very hard when I have them both, because in a way they're kind of the same. You know, they both can't walk, they both can't talk, they both can't self-feed, they're both not toileting themselves. You know, typically Luella would be toilet trained or toilet training. You know, I could put her down to have a snack while I fed Tom.
Yeah.
She would play happily while I was feeding Tom close by. But when I'm having to kind of jump up every 5 seconds to stop her from toppling over or to attend to a seizure, it's actually just not safe, which is why we had to get Crystal to help, because when Luella has a seizure, you know, she loses consciousness, so she falls over and she can hit her head and injure herself. So she needs full-time 24/7 supervision. She cannot be left alone or unsupervised for a second because it's not safe. No. I'm still trying to find my feet and I'm still trying to work it all out, and it feels like a real lot. But it's also amazing at the same time, because I see Tom. He just wants to love her, and he just wants her love, and he has it. But it's also heartbreaking because, you know, she's not able to teach him or show him all the things that a toddler of her age typically would. And, you know, it'll be the other way around. Tom will teach her and Tom will show her and all of those things, and that's going to be amazing for both of them.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of heartbreak that come with, you know, global developmental delay, which is what she has from all the seizures. So
yeah. And just in that, I remember you doing a post on Instagram that was kind of saying, you know, you get messages saying just think positively, like, you know, and all the rest of it. But actually, no, it's okay for some things to be beautiful and it's okay for some things to be fucking hard, and that's okay. Right. Like, you don't actually need for everything to be positive all the time. And I love that you advocate for that, because it's so fucking true, especially in your situation. Like, things are allowed to be shit.
Yeah. You know? And I think, you know, again, every parent has times that they find incredibly hard. I think parenting is the hardest thing especially females will ever do. It's harder than any job we'll ever do. And I think someone said this to me recently, that she said, I think people have a hard time being okay with the fact that you're not okay. People don't understand how I can't just be okay with the cards we've been dealt. And again, I'm not okay with my daughter. I'm not okay with epilepsy, and there's a very big difference. I hate epilepsy. I hate it. I don't hate anything more, and I would never wish it upon my worst enemy. That's how much it's such an awful experience with this condition. So I try not to sugarcoat things because I kind of got sick of it. And in the beginning, there was all of these books about how to, you know, see life with these challenges as a gift. And watching your child suffer is not a gift.
No.
I guess I'm just trying to keep it real for what it is for me. And my experience is mine. My feelings are mine, and I shouldn't have to experience things differently because other people aren't okay with how I experience this.
Yeah, and do you know what? I say this all the time, but it rings even more true in your situation. You know, society prides itself on, let's open up the conversation, you know, are you okay, all the rest of it. Let's take away the stigma of struggling and mental health. And then the second that you do, people are like, oh, you're complaining, look at things differently, you don't know how lucky you are. And it's like, actually, that is the reason why depression and suicide and everything rates are so high, because even though people say, let's talk, I'm here for you, blah, 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 people do feel uncomfortable hearing the truth. They would feel better if you felt better. And so
100%.
They'd rather just not talk about it or hear the truth about people's reality. But it's like, which one is it? Like, you can't not talk about things. That's just
exactly.
Not how it goes.
It's like, you know, mental health is such a big thing, especially, you know, for women with postnatal and everything that can go on at home, you know, ensure these little humans survive.
Yeah.
But when then you're attacked or brought down because your mental health is not at its best because of your lived experience, you are then considered, like you said, to be a complainer. Or, you know, recently there's been some really bad messaging, really negative messaging coming through to me about this exactly. And people are just being awful. You know, some people are saying that I should, you know, be locked up and the key thrown away based on my mental health.
Gosh.
And it's just awful.
Oh, thanks. That's going to make my mental health a lot better, those kind of comments.
Yeah, like, do you know what I mean?
How is that helpful?
And I just thought we'd moved, I thought society had moved into women supporting women. And most of this is coming from women.
Shocking.
And it's just, it really is shocking.
Yeah.
Because if they really were concerned, wouldn't they say, hey, I'm here?
Yeah.
I know you don't know me, but, you know, I'm a lifeline if you need one.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that a better approach than hating on someone or trying to bring them down because they're not okay? They're not coping. I know that that gets frustrating for other people. It certainly has been my experience where people close to us are frustrated that I just can't get on with it. Or I can't be or behave or whatever, how they want me to be. And that has caused them to step away because I can't be what they want. And it's a really awful experience when you think you have a support network, but really just because you're not meeting their standards anymore, they turn their backs on you. And that has really been our experience with friends, with family. It's been very hard.
King of women supporting women, I wanted to end the interview talking about your beautiful little friendship group because I love seeing it on social media and you guys just bring each other up so much. Do you want to tell our listeners, for those who don't know, like your really tight little circle who have all lived through awful experiences themselves as well?
They have. Rachel Casella, Kira Rumble, Jade Reynolds. Four of us really have connected. They've really gravitated towards me and Luella, and they have become my people where I can openly talk about what is really going on behind the scenes because, you know, people need to remember that what they see on social media is such a small snippet. You know, you might see a story highlight and you might see a few of those and that's just minutes of 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that.
Yeah.
And they really have shown my daughter a love that is just so beautiful that, you know, because our friend groups prior to these girls, you know, dissolved and then things have just we've parted ways with other people in our life. It's been a really nice experience to have the doors open to some of these women who have been to hell and back. They've lost children. They've been on incredibly hard IVF journeys. It's been awful and horrific for them. And being able to connect with them in different ways, our experiences aren't the same. But our grief is so similar because I do grieve a lot of the life I thought I would have and the daughter I thought, you know, the life I thought she would have. That's not possible. And, you know, being able to relate to that grief, it's kept me above water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're amazing women and I feel very, very lucky to have had them in my life and they've done incredible things for us as a family and for Luella in ways to support us. And it's beyond anything that I've ever experienced from any other human beings. And I love them very dearly. They're very important.
I'm going to cry. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, they're very important to me.
No, I'm so happy. I'd be lost without them. I'm so glad you've all got each other to help support each other through all of your journeys, because you have had Rachel on the podcast before. I would love to speak to Kira and Jade as well about, you know, their life experience too, but maybe that's something I can organise down the track.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they'd be very, very open to sharing with your community. Yeah, because their experiences, like I said, are very different, really deserve to be shared.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come on today to speak with us. I know it's not easy to talk about, and I appreciate your vulnerability so much. I think that our listeners will take so much away from this interview with you and, you know, open so many people's eyes and perspectives and minds to, you know, what life is like for some people.
Yeah. No, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been an honour to chat with you, and thank you for all of your support. You know, obviously listening today, and also, you know, through Bloom Disability Support Network and helping us find Crystal, it has honestly been life-changing. And, yeah, we are just so grateful for all of your help. It's been amazing.
Oh, you are so welcome. Thanks so much, Erin.
Thanks, Steph.